So I'm Raj Reddy. I was born in a small village called Kattur near Kalahasti in the Chittoor district of Andhra Pradesh. And I spent the first 9 years of my life in the village. And I don't remember much of my early childhood. But I can try to describe whatever the detail I remember of that part of the time. I was born in 1937. That makes my early childhood pre-World War II, roughly 1937 to 1942. And at that time, this village probably had no more than 300 to 500 people. It was a typical agricultural community. And in this community, it was a complete ecosystem that meant every profession that was needed for the community to survive without the benefit of the external world was all there. And that meant there were barbers and then washerwomen and clerks and coolies and we were probably the richest family in the village and or maybe even in the neighboring surrounding 10-mile radius, but compared to really rich, we were what you would call poor, a lower middle class in the current context. And we had the only two-story building in the village, and that house is still there when I recently visited, and my sister still lives there. But the important part of that I remember is at that time, you had to be very careful because there was a 7-year drought, I believe, at that time. I don't fully remember it because there was a shortage of water, but I never had to go thirsty at that time. But the amount of food and crops and other things available were very small. And that meant a lot of people were going hungry, and this meant my family would try to help out in the village and in the neighborhood, but they didn't have that much to be able to share across the board. But one of the tenets of the Hindu Dharma was that you fed, other people up and you eat yourself, right? So it was an interesting part of that time. And what was the particular characteristics of this village? It had probably three main streets, one going east-west, another going south and another going north, and the street that went north met up with the main rural highway that went to Madras, and the south of Madras was about 50 miles away, and most people were kind of agriculturists and not that well off, but Kattur as a whole was probably more prosperous than many of the neighboring villages. Now I'd like to describe the people in my family. We were 7 brothers and 3 sisters, 7 brothers and sisters, 4 brothers and 3 sisters. And my father's name was Srinivasal Reddy. He was one of the 2 children to my grandfather, who only had 2 sons. And for a long time, both of my father and his brother lived in a joint family. And at some point, they divided the property. I don't remember that division, but as long as I can remember, we were kind of sharing the same big house with a wall in between. I was kind of fourth sibling out of the seven, right in the middle. It was a interesting position to be in, because my two elder brothers were expected to grow up and look after the property, the land that we had around the village and the neighboring communities. That meant me, as the third son, was relatively free to do whatever I wanted to do. And that's how I ended up getting a better education than my two brothers, who were told that they could not go past the high school education because they were needed to stay home and look after the properties. My mother was a dear young lady at that time. I remember when I was a five-year-old or one-year-old. She was always known for her peaceful countenance and the willingness to be helpful to other people. And of course, we were part of a much bigger family. My mother had, two more brothers and two more sisters, total of five of them. So at any given time, many of them would be, she was the eldest child of her family, and so many of them would be staying with us in our house. And that was one of the good things that happened to me, because my mother's younger brother took a great deal of interest in my own education and would kind of show me things to get me interested in mathematics and geometry and so on. So one of the great pleasures of my youth is when I was kind of rediscovering mathematical proofs that I would not have thought about if my uncle, as we call them, my brother's brother, did not show me the pleasure that you can get when you rediscover the proof of a theorem by yourself without somebody else telling you. We had, being an agricultural family, we had a lot of cows and sheep and chicken and all kinds of things all the time around us. And thus, understanding of the social systems was something that could be actually collected, understood. My father, as I said, was an agriculturist, a landlord, and he would actually kind of supervise the cultivation of our lands, but at the same time, he had a creative part of creative inventive part of his psychological makeup, where he was able to do some things that were considered to be, you know, magic in the village. For example, we had a bore well, or a well, which had water coming in through the aquifers or whatever the below. And so, but the water, the well, was about a mile away from the lands we had. And so that meant he had to figure out, you know, how to get the water to the, normally you would say there's a canal in between, this water can't go to the fields on the other side. So I think he saw in his travels that water can be transported up and down through water pipes. And I believe when you go to Madras, you see the big pipe, water pipe, going all the way from Red Hills to Madras City, which is about 15, 20 miles away. And that kind of gives you an idea. Maybe water can be transported on a pipe and it doesn't have to go through a level field. And he must have kind of seen that and then said, why can't I have a water pipe from one end to the other so that the water that's plentiful on one side could actually be transported to the other side where it is needed to irrigate the fields. And so he went ahead and did that. And it obviously required significant capital investment on his part. And at that time, of course, finding capital is a big deal. So I don't know how he managed, but he did. And that was an interesting experiment. It was almost like magic for the entire village when the water started coming out on the other side after going well below the ground and then coming up above the ground. So, that was what my father did, and he used to be what they called village munsif at that time, which is village headman, if you want to think of it that way. And in that position, he was kind of responsible for various administrative functions of the village, but that was probably something he had even without any government sanctions, because everybody would come to him asking for support or administrative help or whatever. And it was an interesting time, that is, now I think, as I think of it, 1937 to 1942, I remember the war breaking out. There were some words like Germans and Hitler and so on that we heard, but we had no clue what they were, that a Hitler was a person and the Germans were a race or something. But these were words that were floating around in the system. At that time, we did not have a radio, we did not have electricity, we did not have running water. Many of these things have since been added to the village, but it took a long time. It's actually, throughout my youth, there was no electricity and running water, so you had to actually pump the water from the well, or actually pull up the water through manual labor. So it was a different kind of things that you had to do. So how was my family similar or different from other families? I assume at that point not everybody had clothes to wear. So it is not uncommon for many poorer people to simply have one piece of cloth, you know, covering the lower body and nothing else. And they would be, you know, mainly day laborers, if you want to think of it that way. But many of them would work for us on a semi-permanent basis around the year. And they would get a fixed amount of pay, and the pay in those days was largely in kind. You received, you know, one bag or two bags of rice, or unground rice, and which then, of course, you had to grind to remove the husk and so on. And as I said, there were other people in the village who were professionals. Some people, some of them were metal worksmiths, metal workers. Others were day laborers. Others were barbers, and others made mud vessels and baked them. And it was a whole self-sufficient community. What was my favorite activity as a child? My favorite activity as a child was running away from school. I didn't like attending school at all, and therefore every time they would kind of take me to the school at the age of 4 or 5, I would run away from the school and go somewhere and play. And ultimately, it took my mother, got lost her patience, and had to take a cane and beat me. And once I was sufficiently chastened, I guess I started going to school. And the first part of the school, which is probably in the first 5 years, was learning how to write letters. And when I tell my story to people in the USA, they kind of say, my God, you know, what does that mean? But most children that go to school in India probably have been through similar situation. The way you learn to write the letters is to, you know, kind of write them in the sand. And the way you do that, of course, is, you know, you may have a slate, certainly not a lot of paper and pens and pencils, for sure. And so in the sand, you would trace the letters or write the letters and practice them one letter after the other. And then you would kind of repeat orally all the multiplication tables. And so it was a different types of, you know, kind of learning, which is, compared to the Western educational system, was very primitive. But given that the amount of money spent on primary schools in India is probably, I would say, 1/100th of the funds that are spent here, that was all that could be afforded at that time. Even today, it's still probably 1/20th to 1/100th of the investment that's made in the United States. So, recall the events of your childhood. Now, the one event I remember very well is the wedding of my mother's sister. And she was getting married to a young person about 10 miles away. And so, since this was a close family wedding, all of us got brand new clothes and shoes and socks and everything else, so that we would be all dressed like a little, you know, English boys and go to this wedding. And then my father's elder brother, Kaznana, came into the house and said, when is the wedding? I don't seem to have received an invitation. And so my father said, is that so? Let me see. And it so happened, because we were all very close family, neither us nor my father's brother's family got any official invitation. Of course, my mother's brother was there, and he said, I'm here inviting you. And they said, no, you never sent us an official formal invitation. So, and you know, this became a major crisis. And my father, being a stickler for formalities, essentially decreed that none of the family will go to the wedding. And it was a major blow to everybody because we're all looking forward to going there. And the only person that went and attended the wedding was my mother. And she didn't go as the sister of the bride, which is what she was, but she, the family of the bridegroom had sent us an official invitation. And so she went on the basis of that invitation, but only one member of the family went because they're not close to us. Like, you know, if it was we're going to attend my mother's sister's wedding, the whole family would go, and only this one person went. And so the whole wedding was kind of down in a gloom that everybody kind of felt that rather than enjoying and having a good time, they essentially, it was kind of not a fiasco, but I think half of the joy of having a wedding was killed because of my father's decision of sticking to the rules of the formal invitation. Anyway, it kind of reminds me about how little things become important in the life of families and where misunderstandings can arise. Another event that happened at that time is before we were declared to be not allowed to go to the wedding, and I had all these new clothes and shoes and socks, and so, you know, I had never worn any shoes, so these shoes were given to me, so I put them on, and then I was happily walking around with my socks and shoes. These were kind of canvas shoes, like the ones used for walking these days, I guess. And one of our relatives from the city was visiting the village. And so he said, he looked at the shoes I was wearing and laughed and said something. And I did not know what he was saying, so I walked away. And then later on my father came and then said that, you know, he asked me to come to him. He said, "Do you see what your shoes you're wearing?" I said, "Yeah." You know, so you see, you're wearing the left shoe and the right foot, and the right shoe and the left foot. I said, "How do you tell?" You know, I don't have any idea where the left shoe and the right shoe is. And so he kind of showed me how you would kind of look at the sole and then, you know, kind of see which is the left and the right foot. And I felt really ashamed that I was the source of laughter, or people were laughing at the way I was kind of behaving. But nobody else probably remembers it. But I do, you know, I did remember, because it was one of those events that you kind of think about and say, how come it happened, you know. Anyway, what did we do every day? I don't completely remember, but you know, every morning and evening we'll probably have a hot water bath, and there'll be usually servants that would kind of pour water on your head and do various other soaping and cleaning and making sure that you're clean. And then we would eat breakfast, and all that I remember is, if you happened to be a boy in the family, you didn't have to go into the kitchen and do any work. But if you happen to be a daughter in the family, then you have to go and help with the cooking and cleaning and all the other things. But, you know, there were enough servants, of course, to do the cleaning, but nevertheless, you know, all the family activities, boys were thankfully ignored or not required to do anything. And so you had more time to loaf and goof off than if you were a young girl in the family. And we didn't move the house at all. In fact, the only time I changed residences when I went to Kalahasti to go to school, and that was after almost 9 years. So the first 9 years, I just grew up in this village. So major events that happened in to members of the family. Ah, yes. One of the two events I remember at that time is my older brother. Of course, being the eldest son, he was the apple of the eye, so to speak. Everybody kind of spoiled him and kind of looked after him, except my father, who was a taskmaster, who was kind of strict with everybody. But so one day he was climbing a tree and he fell down from the tree and broke his hand. And this was a major event in everybody's life. And in those days, if you have a fracture of the hand, you know, you may never heal. And so in our case, we didn't have so-called orthopedic surgeons or anything. And so there was a bone setter family, I would say probably about 30 miles away. And so they had to kind of put him in a bullock cart and take him the 30 miles, and then they set his, you know, set the the bones and with splints and other things, put a not bandage, you know, kind of a cast. It was not a cast like you think of as a cast today. It was just a brace, I assume, of some sort with multiple wooden pieces, and then tied tightly around it so that the whole hand would kind of have the opportunity to set and heal. Anyway, it was as though somebody died, you know, because the whole family was in gloom and everybody was speaking in whispers, and it was one of those events that you kind of think of for a long time afterwards. And the second time, we were kind of at the family, and suddenly somebody ran up and told my father that one of my brothers was bit by a snake. And you know, and now of course most snakes are not poisonous, but we didn't have any way of knowing which is poisonous and which is not, because the quality of the learning and education at that time and even now is pretty poor. So we have no special education about poisonous snakes and poisonous mushrooms and poisonous various things, as opposed to 90% of the snakes that are not poisonous. So anyway, and this was, you know, caused yet another major crisis in the family, and we didn't know whether it was poisonous or not. Fortunately, it turned out it was not poisonous, so anyway, ultimately everything worked out. But at the time, it was a major event in the household. Family vacations and regular activities. One of the interesting aspects of living in villages in India is you never take vacations, and you never play golf, and you never go stay in hotels, and that's all for the rich in the cities. And the only vacation you go on is pilgrimages. It turns out you all kind of as a family go to your family deity, and in our case it was to go to Tirupati, which is about 25-30 miles from where I was born. And and that was a major event. And of course whatever activities we did were kind of wonderful, wondrous, because you were kind of seeing and doing things that you had never experienced before. And a second event that happened at that time is Kalahasti is famous for Shiva temple, Sri Kalahasti. And once a year, there is a festival time called Sivaratri, that usually happens in February, March. And the whole city becomes a major tourist attraction. Everybody from the neighboring communities all descend on Kalahasti. And then there are, you know, snake charmers and jugglers and circuses and people selling, you know, all kinds of exotic fruit like dates. Dates is not native to our part of the country. And so, you know, you kind of buy some dates and they're so sweet and you kind of think that's the best thing you've eaten in a long time. And so what happened this time around was I was a very young, I think 4 or 5 year old, and my elder brother and brothers wanted to go off on their own, but I wanted to tag along. And so they said, why don't you go do X? I don't remember what they said, as a way of kind of getting me out of their hair. So I was supposed to go home and pick up something and come back, which I did. When I came back, they were not there. And there was so many crowds, I was completely lost as a five-year-old. So ultimately, I was essentially lost. So my family started worrying because I didn't show up. Nobody knew where I was. And that's why I was kind of picked up by the police because I was crying or whatever, and taken to the police station, where I promptly fell asleep. And after 6 hours or so, I was rediscovered and united with the family. And as a result of that, of course, they were happy to see me, but both of my brothers were punished severely for letting me, not taking care of me, so to speak. So it's it was not quite a family vacation, but the festival times and pilgrimages are the things that usually substitute for vacations in India, or at least in village India. We called and described close friends I had with my as a childhood. I had a close friend. I think he may still be alive. I haven't seen him in almost 10 years. He was a young Muslim boy. We used to play together, and okay. So I was explaining if I had any close friends as a child. Yes, I did, but not very many. I don't remember all my friends from the first 5 years or whatever. But the things we used to do are essentially things you do in a village, which are, you know, village-level games. We didn't have any football or balls or tennis balls or any of those kinds of things. We didn't have nets, and so we, our hoops. So many of the classical things you would think about in games that you would play as a child were not available, nor were there table games or any kinds of other things that are usual here. But we had our own ways of entertaining, and I was just trying to explain what they were, but I've forgotten what they were. They were primarily of the form, you know, that you would kind of hold your breath and keep repeating a sound over and over again, and then cross a line, and there's a name of this game, I've forgotten what it's called, Pagadi or something. But the whole idea is, as long as you have breath, you can stay on the other side of the lane. And after that, if you lose your breath and they catch you, then you have lost the game or that particular set or something. So there were other games like hop skip and not hop skip and jump, hopscotch I think, where you jumped through squares and did various types of things. But other than, I'm sure we had lots of pretend games of various types. It's just that I can't recollect what they were at that time. But I'm sure if somebody mentioned some games, I would probably remember, oh, we used to do that too, kind of thing. Okay? Thank you very much.